and for helping us with this program and co-sponsoring. So thank you so much.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity, the Institute, to co-sponsor this event and to help select the speakers and think about it. I think, well, Richard was saying it's really a nice opportunity to come and speak to a different group than, let's say, climate change scientists. And so having a climate change scientist, this is Richard, here to speak to the Center Institute for Comparative for Social Theory and Comparative History, I think it really says a lot of the issues that we're tackling with climate change, which is it is not strictly a scientific issue, nor is it strictly an economics issue. It's also a social issue, and I think we're bringing in Matt and Richard here. It looks at multifaceted sort of approach to what is a very much a multifaceted issue. And so it's very exciting to come and to hear these people speak, but I know they're excited to share it with this audience. Now, Richard Somerville, for anyone who's at all involved into the nuts and bolts of climate change, is really one of the giants, one of the leaders in the field nationally and internationally. He has been associated with the leading climate laboratories, which have generated many of the models that you see used to predict what the future is going to hold for us in terms of climate or what's going on today. The General Fluid Dynamics Laboratory at Princeton University, NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research, for example, New York at Goddard, and then now for a number of years at Scripps at UC San Diego. He retired from there in 2007 as an emeritus distinguished professor. Retirement, though, is just a gloss because Richard remains very, very active and very, very busy. Now, he has over 150 scientific publications. His work is in one of the trickiest areas of thinking about how the climate works or how it will be in the future, which really is sort of mathematical modeling of meteorological effects. Particularly one of his areas of specialty is clouds. And clouds are notoriously difficult to work with, to incorporate in models. Richard's stature was such that he is one of the organizing contributors, one of the organizing authors of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report, the fourth assessment report. That is the assessment report which shared with Al Gore the Nobel Prize. And it's certainly one of the most important documents in terms of tackling climate change and thinking about what's going to happen, and also one of the most controversial, as it turns out. So for those of you who followed ClimateGate, have followed some of the controversy about the fourth assessment report, IPCC in Copenhagen, well, you can blame Richard for all that. No, we have one of the leaders who can really tell us about that document inside and out. So really, it is a pleasure to welcome Richard to this series and to UCLA.
Okay, well, thanks for the very kind words, thanks for inviting me, and thanks to all of you for coming. I'm going to be careful not to talk for more than 45 minutes so that we have plenty of time for Matt and for discussion later. And I really want to update you all on the status of climate science, but also to raise some possibilities for discussion. I really want to mention some of the issues that are involved in the science policy interface. I want to talk to you about my impressions of the Copenhagen UN climate negotiations last December, and I want to speak to some of the obstacles and opportunities ahead. And it's a very great pleasure to be here. I've been a professor at Scripps for 30 years, and every time I come to LA, it makes me happy, and I welcome the chance to speak to people like you who aren't people exactly like me. And I have a confession to make. I retired, which, as you know, in the University of California is a kind of self-designed promotion. And I'm back at work doing the things I love, and I've extricated myself from doing the things I'm less in love with. And I'm becoming a historian. I'm dead serious about this. I hang out with historians of science, people like Naomi Oreskes at UCSD and Eric Conway across town at JPL in Pasadena. I've joined the History of Science Society. I can use words like historiography and historicity with a straight face, which very few theoretical climatologists can do. And I go to their meetings, and they show me around, mentor me, introduce me, say, this is our scientist. And I've decided it's a wonderful second career for somebody like me. I especially like the way that in history, you don't burn out at 20 or 30 like mathematical scientists do, but instead you're still accumulating sagacity and judgment into your 80s and 90s. I think this appeals as a second career. So let me say a word about the greenhouse effect. It's often misattributed to Fourier, and that's basically because of amateur historians relying on secondary sources. So the last Fourier paper that I show here, the 1827 paper, is really a kind of a review paper with no equations. Fourier was a great mathematical scientist, and he had in fact spent, as you see here, many years thinking about the greenhouse effect, but it goes back to a French scientist named Mariotte who flourished in the 17th century, and I'm working on him right now. But as early as the early 19th century, it was clear to many, many scientists that there were gases in the atmosphere, water vapor, carbon dioxide, others were identified later, that were opaqued in the infrared. They let sunlight in, but they acted as a blanket, roughly speaking, and prevented the Earth from radiating heat to space and kept the planet warmer than it otherwise would be. In fact, without those gases we know now, Earth would be below freezing on average, and life as we know it wouldn't exist. And I think the real breakthrough, you might say, scientifically, came when John Tyndall, who was an Irishman working in England, did experiments. So this is middle of the 19th century. He put CO2, carbon dioxide, water vapor, other gases in tubes in physics laboratories, and he exposed them to infrared beams, and he measured the absorption of heat. And Arrhenius, the last person I mentioned here, who was no slouch, Arrhenius won a Nobel Prize in chemistry, he computed the effect of these greenhouse gases on the climate. He was actually interested in whether carbon dioxide might have had something to do with the transition into and out of ice ages. And he arrived, theoretically, after years of laborious hand calculations, at an estimate of how sensitive the climate would be to CO2. For example, how much warming you would see if you doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And his estimates were within a factor of two of the right answers that we know about today. My point is, this is a very old subject scientifically with deep roots in classical physics. And all of this work, by the way, was done pre-quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tells you why CO2 is a greenhouse gas. Pre-satellites, pre-spectroscopy. So people knew empirically, and with what you might say rough theoretical foundations, that this was real, that if you change the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you were going to change the climate. So this is something that I think we've been living with for a long time. But if you think about it from a physicist's point of view, it becomes a quantitative question. If we add CO2 and the other gases as mankind is doing, the question is not whether the climate is going to change. That's settled. The question is, how much is it going to change? How fast will the change occur? What will that manifest itself as in terms of changes in hurricanes, changes in sea levels, changes in precipitation patterns, and so on? But that mankind has the ability to change the climate by altering the composition of the atmosphere is just a given. I'm going to jump ahead now. I think the first major policy development was this treaty signed by virtually every country and ratified by the U.S., which is in force, but it's an aspirational treaty. It simply says, as you can read here, the ultimate objective is to stabilize the amount of greenhouse gases, concentration is jargons, at a level that prevents dangerous human-caused interference with climate. Now, dangerous wasn't defined in 1992 when President Bush the first signed this at the Earth Summit in Rio, and hasn't been defined since then to everybody's satisfaction. So there's no legally binding treaty framework for saying how much greenhouse gases added to the atmosphere is dangerous or not. But there's been a lot of progress, and there is now, you might say, a working agreement among nations that they've signed on to varying degrees. The European Union, for example, is legally signed on to the target that warming should be limited to 2 degrees Celsius, or 3.6 Fahrenheit, above the average pre-industrial 19th century temperature, that is, the temperatures before mankind started tampering significantly with the chemical composition of the atmosphere. And the U.S. and other countries have agreed with this in various non-binding ways. So it's the nearest thing we have today to a number that has some sense of international validity. Once you've set that number, which is not a science decision, it's a decision that's political, that depends on risk tolerance and values and lots of other things. Once you've set such a number, then science comes to your rescue. And that's what I really want to talk about momentarily. But there's still issues that haven't been agreed to. Is that dangerous? Or is that some kind of target, that 2 degrees Celsius above the 19th century? Is that some kind of target with a built-in safety factor or something like that? And if you don't make that target, how much climate change is tolerable? What are you willing to live with? Again, these are not science issues. Then you also have to look at the fact that the responsibility for creating this problem and solving it is very unequally distributed. The U.S. has roughly 5% of the population of the world and has contributed roughly a quarter of the burden of greenhouse gases that are now in the atmosphere. By the way, these gases tend to have a large lifetime. So if you put CO2 in the atmosphere today, because it comes about from many, many processes, chiefly burning fossil fuels, so you burn coal, oil, and natural gas, your engine converts the carbon in the gasoline into CO2 by mixing it with oxygen in the air, and that CO2 molecule that came out of your tailpipe on the way to work this morning is likely to be in the atmosphere for centuries. So you're doing something that affects the climate of your distant descendants. And that tells you right away that there are going to be intergenerational equity issues here. There's going to be discussions of fairness, of responsibility, of the applicability of polluter pays principles, and so on. And the degree to which different countries have contributed to the problem has to do with their population and their use of fossil fuels. There are also a number of other industrial processes. Land use changes also contribute to CO2. But the overwhelmingly big one is burning coal and oil and natural gas, which are, in round numbers, 80% of the world's energy system today. So the world runs on energy. Wealthy countries use much more of it. And using that energy primarily from fossil fuels causes the problem. So the U.S., as I said, with 5% of the population, has contributed about a quarter of the problem. Roughly one out of the four man-made CO2 molecules in the atmosphere is there for American reasons. On the other hand, China has recently passed the U.S. in recent years as the single largest contributing country to CO2. And the bulk of the additional CO2 that will be added to the atmosphere comes from large, rapidly developing countries, China, India, Brazil, Russia, and so on, so-called BRIC countries, and many others. And finally, there are these north-south issues, the last point on this slide. Many of these negotiations, to oversimplify them only a little, consist of finger-pointing and claims that, for example, from the developing world, that you and the rich West caused the problem. Why should our people, who also aspire to what you would consider a barely acceptable lifestyle, be denied it because you have caused this problem? Why should we in China and India, for example, forego the exploitation of cheap, readily available fossil fuel energy? Countered by responses from the developed world saying what I've just said, it's true we caused the problem, but the problem has been tolerable up till now, and it's going to be exacerbated greatly because you, with your much greater numbers, are going down this route of rapid development on fossil fuels. I've interspersed a micro talk on population just to tell you something that is critical to this problem and which no politician can afford to talk about. It's such a hot button issue. And in fact, you will find that when the UN holds conferences on population, environmental issues such as climate are never brought up and vice versa. And so that there's a tacit agreement we don't combine these two because they're both such hot issues that you'd get gridlock and no progress if you were forced to discuss them at the same table. Nonetheless, there's a very clear connection. Population is a driver for this issue. And the world population is still growing. It's still growing very rapidly. You know, it first reached 1 billion in the early 19th century, and it reached 2 billion about 1930. And it's still growing, as you can see here. We're now at not quite 7 billion, and with median forecasts by mid-century of 9 billion, and all the growth in population is now occurring in the developing world. There are some developed countries, notably the U.S., that are still rapidly growing, but there are also developed countries whose population is shrinking drastically. And so that if you average over the whole world, the growth that we foresee over coming decades, which as I'll come to explain are critical, that growth is largely the province of the developing world. These charts are very telling. You know, this is an age in the vertical axis, males on the left, females on the right, and you often see this kind of chart typifying the population distribution of a developed country. So there are very few children or young adults, say below 20, relative to populations in the middle of the age distribution. You can see on the right-hand side at the top that women live longer than men and so on. But this is to be contrasted. This is a typical graph. It's a graph you might see, for example, for France or Germany. Here's what you might see for Congo or Rwanda, with a huge pyramid with large numbers of people in the younger age groups, relatively few in the older age groups. Here again, at the top, you can see that women are living longer than men. Nonetheless, there's a lot of male-female symmetry in this distribution. And what it means is that there are many people in their childbearing years and coming into their childbearing years. There's also a huge difference between countries in total fertility rates. And I think that this gives hope. I spend a lot of time working with and talking with demographers. And we know how to reduce total fertility rates. We know how to stabilize population. We know that women worldwide are having more children than they want. But different countries have taken very different routes to this. And they don't by any means all conform to the stereotype of, say, Western Europe, with wealth, political equality, education, empowerment of women, and so on. There are many other routes. And so here, for example, time goes left to right here, from 1950 on the left to the present on the right, for several different countries. And you can see Congo, for example, here, in which there's not been much change in total fertility rates, but you see a number of other countries in which they've been drastically reduced. And the reduction has occurred in countries that don't at all resemble Sweden, for example. Iran is a case in which it's drastically reduced total fertility rates. And it depends on many things that politicians can't talk about. It depends, for example, on the availability not only of cheap, socially effective family planning technology, but also of socially acceptable abortions that are also affordable and not stigmatized. But I don't want to go into that, so I'm a meteorologist, but I want to say that it's a critical element of this problem. And had the world stabilized at, say, 2 billion in the 1930 population, we would have far, far less of a climate crisis and many other crises involved with exploiting finite resources than we do today. The U.S. is the exception among developed countries. So in the late 1960s, when I was a postdoc, the U.S. population was 200 million. Today it's more than 300 million. It's, as you see, rising roughly linear, and so by mid-century, it will be above 400 million. And this is a country with a very high per capita consumption of resources, including fossil fuels. The U.S. is very much anomalous, and this is the last of my population mini-talk slides. You can see here, this is the percent change in population over a period of roughly four decades, from 2008 to 2050. And the U.S. is projected to grow during that time by 44%. Population projections are quite accurate for the near term because they depend on existing fertility rates and the number of people in the various age cohorts. They get very fuzzy as you try to extend them longer. And you can see that there are only a few countries shown here whose population rates are strongly positive, and there's still all of them less than that of the U.S., whereas many developed countries, you see them in the other color, their populations are shrinking, and sometimes drastically. So that's the end of that, but I hope we can talk about that, because we're not running for office, so we ought to be allowed to bring it into the conversation. The IPCC has been mentioned. I'm happy to answer questions about ClimateGate and the corrupt and incompetent hoaxers and scammers of whom I am one. And I'll tell you that the fact is that the IPCC has a sterling record. It is the gold standard for scientific assessments of climate change science. And the attacks on it under careful review melt away, their propaganda, their lies, their deliberate disinformation. And we use IPCC reports as textbooks for our graduate students, and so do others worldwide. I'm very proud to have spent 3 years of my life as a coordinating lead author for the last IPCC report. IPCC was established in 1988. It issues these reports about every 6 years, so four have come out. The next one comes out in 2013. And the reports are 3,000 pages long. For people who don't have time, there's a summary of about 100 pages. And for the media, there's a one-sentence conclusion. So here's the one-sentence conclusion for the last three reports. In 95, and by the way, these things, if that sentence at the top here, balance of evidence, suggests this one, if that looks like a negotiated, lawyerly, committee-borne sentence, it is. These are put together in plenaries following the scientists writing the report. And plenaries occur like little mini UN General Assemblies, in which the rule is unanimous consent. So every country, these are governments now, wordsmithing the science. The scientists are there to make sure that governments don't stray away from scientific fact. But the governments get to choose the nuance. And the rule is unanimous consent. So if a single country digs in its heels and says, we cannot agree to that term, it stays on the floor. So your country, no matter where you're from, has agreed to this language. And in 95, it was true that many scientists were skeptical, and the evidence wasn't anywhere near as convincing as it has subsequently become. But by 2001, the third assessment report of the four, the first one I haven't shown here, it was kind of inconclusive. But the third report, there's new and stronger evidence that most, that means more than half, of the warming over the last half century is human caused. And then,
can you take that again?
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing that second statement. This is unanimously agreed to by governments, drafted by scientists, by the way, and not departing much from the original draft. But there is new and stronger evidence, that is between 95 and 2001, that most of the warming observed over the last 50 years is attributable to human activity. It's human caused. The warming is not natural. We have a lot of reasons for knowing this. I'll come to some of them in a moment. But that was agreed to, as I said, 2001, 9 years ago. Which means, by the way, the IPCC doesn't do research. What it does is it assesses the published peer-reviewed technical research literature, thousands of papers. And it comes to conclusions. It doesn't force a consensus where none exists, but where the science has become settled, the research frontier has moved on, the IPCC says so. Where there are dissenting views, it cites them. Where there's still research to be done and the results are inconclusive, it says that. And as I say, it is these results, by the way, of the IPCC have been repeatedly vetted and endorsed by national academies of science and professional societies of scientists worldwide. There just isn't any doubt about this. This is the gold standard in science assessments. The few trivial misprints, typos, and small errors, incidentally, that have been found and trumpeted by the dark side and in the news media, don't come from the part of the IPCC that does the assessment of the physical science of climate change. They come from other parts of IPCC that deal with things like mitigation of climate change, adaptation to climate change, impacts of climate change. But the physical science has been rock solid. It's really, when you think of it, kind of extraordinary because, you know, there are, you get errors in your bank statement, there are errors in the phone book, but you don't call for the head of the third organization's responsible. It's just a huge propaganda and disinformation campaign. That's the reason why anybody has heard of ClimateGate and so on. Incidentally, the hacked emails by the scientists, my emails are among those hacked, the scientists involved have been repeatedly investigated by their own universities, exonerated, completely cleared. So here's from the last IPCC report. There are two one-sentence summary statements here. Warming of the climate system is unequivocal. I'm supposed to be in a hurry, but let me tell you a story so you get a feel for how this goes on. This language was negotiated in a week-long plenary session of 14-hour days in Paris, in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower, across the street from the school where Napoleon studied military science. And we were not let out. We were locked in. There's no press there, and fed soggy cellophane wrapped sandwiches. There are 3-star restaurants across the street. And somebody in the wordsmithing takes a week to wordsmith what for us was a 30-page document for the physical science section. Somebody whose country had French as one of the languages, but not the main language, said you couldn't say unequivocal. You had to say warming of the climate system is evident because, he said, in French, the language of diplomacy, it was impossible to say unequivocal. At that, the French delegate got up, veins standing out of his neck, face apoplectically purple, and assured everybody that the French language is perfectly capable of saying unequivocal. I live in France half the year, so I knew that, and it's sans équivoque, by the way. So that's how that got in there. But every one of these words is debated. Every figure caption is debated. Every type size in a graphic is debated. But what this says is that the warming cannot be denied and that there are many lines of evidence. It's not, as some would have you believe, a kind of science that hangs from a slender thread and you can destroy the science if you can show that this or that paper had a mistake in it. There are many, many lines of evidence supporting the statement that the world is warming, and you see some of them here. The air is warming, the ocean's warming, snow and ice are decreasing, sea level is rising, and so on. There are many others, too. I urge you to go to the IPCC website there. And the other statement, there's two, as I said, for the 2007 report. Here's the second one. The first one was in the statement that the world is warming. This is a statement of attribution of cause. It says that most of the warming is 9 chances out of 10 or better likely to be caused by increases in human-caused amounts of these greenhouse gases. It's not warming because the sun is changing. You see, we can measure the changes in the sun and convert them to the right units, and they're 10 times smaller than the warming due to CO2. It's not warming because the world is coming out of the last ice age. It's not warming because of cosmic rays. There's just lots you might say, hypothetical causes that don't stand up to quantitative scrutiny. Okay. When that report came out, there was already evidence that the IPCC, or rather the scientific literature it was assessing, was conservative, intellectually conservative. IPCC is completely apolitical. Its mandate, and I think I can say, having suffered through 3 years of this, it's obeyed. The mandate is IPCC does assessments that are policy relevant but not policy prescriptive. So it's talking about things that will be of interest to policymakers without ever advocating a specific policy. It's simply objectively assessing the science. So here's a paper, I'm the last of several authors, that came out right when the IPCC report came out. In fact, on the same day Science published it. They had held our manuscript based on research prior to the report because it's strictly embargoed. You can't talk about the report before it comes out. In which we say here that the previous projections of climate change, future forecasts of possible climate change, may have underestimated the change, and we cited sea level in particular. And that brings me to Copenhagen. This came out kind of dark, but maybe the room lights are low enough. Copenhagen was a disappointment diplomatically in that the outcome was not a binding treaty with targets and teeth and timetable. But it was hugely disappointing logistically, to everyone's surprise, because the Danes are famously great organizers. But they had accredited more than 3 times as many people for the conference center as it would hold. And a lot of people stood in line. I've got 2 pictures of that. Here's another line. A lot of people stood in line in sub-freezing temperatures with snow falling all day. And I have several friends who came from Australia. I was there to present the report that I'm about to show you, who never got in. They turned around and went back to Sydney. It was a massively disorganized, incompetently organized meeting. I've been to many of these so-called COP meetings. This was COP 15. COP means COP, Conference of the Parties, and the parties are the countries which signed the UN Framework Convention from 1992. And so for some reason, and I can't ascribe blame to the local organizers or the UN staff or whoever, but this meeting was a disaster logistically. 3 weeks before the meeting started in December, a group of us had written a report that you can get for free at this URL. it's readable, it's more readable than the IPCC reports. And what we tried to do, this is not an IPCC report, just 26 of us from several countries, half of whom, by the way, have been IPCC authors, so we knew how to do it. And we decided the science had been moving so rapidly since the 2007 IPCC fourth assessment that the Copenhagen negotiators ought to have a handy summary with references. We had hundreds of peer-reviewed papers on which we based our conclusions. And so we put this report online in late November, a few weeks before Copenhagen. And in fact, in the two or three weeks between our posting it and the Copenhagen meeting, it was downloaded more than 200,000 times and very widely reported in the press. And what we tried to do was bring the science up to date. So what I want to do in my remaining time is to show you what we concluded. We didn't have time to get this reviewed through the many stages of the many drafts and many reviews that the IPCC undergoes. So we're quick and nimble, but we're not as thorough as IPCC. But as I said, we're not repudiating or attacking the IPCC conclusions. We're just trying to use the same standards, bringing the science up to date. You pay a price for the long time delay between the IPCC reports. So I'll read this to you first. Greenhouse gas emissions, the rate at which they're being put into the atmosphere, is increasing, not decreasing. Temperatures are rising at about the rate predicted by IPCC, about 0.2°C per decade. There's melting of the entire cryosphere. Ice sheets are melting in Greenland and Antarctica. Sea ice is decreasing. Glaciers on land worldwide are retreating. Sea level is rising at the high end, as our 2007 science paper had said. And that's higher, the forecast, that is at the high end of the range of preceding forecasts. Sea level, you see, has to rise when climate warms. And in fact, the sea level difference we know geologically between ice ages and interglacial periods like today is huge. It's of order 100 meters. It's not a few inches. And the sea level rises in a warming world for two main reasons. One is that the ocean expands thermally, like many things, it takes up more volume when it's hot than when it's cold. And the second is that ice on land melts, turns liquid, and that water eventually flows into the ocean. So you're adding mass to the ocean, too. And by the way, today those are of comparable importance. The ocean is warming. Its heat is being absorbed in the ocean to great depths worldwide. The acidity of the ocean is changing. Ocean acidification is global warming's evil twin. You see, from the chemist's point of view, the ocean is a weak solution of carbonic acid. When you put CO2, carbon dioxide, into the ocean, it dissolves in the water and forms carbonic acid. And as you put more CO2 into the atmosphere, more is absorbed by the ocean. And so the acid becomes less dilute. The pH of the ocean is going down. That means becoming more acidic. And that's a subject in which a lot of research remains to be done, but there are potentially very severe consequences for the base of the marine food chain. For example, small animals that form shells from calcium carbonate are less able to do so in an acidic ocean than in a base ocean. Furthermore, there's an urgency, a time scale. If I have one single message to leave with you today about the consequences of this, it's that we don't have all the time in the world. This is not like negotiating steel tariffs, where if you don't get it done this year, there'll be trade talks next year. Here, Mother Nature imposes a timescale. It has nothing to do with ideology or politics or policy. But the climate system, the lifetime of gases like CO2 in the atmosphere, the rate at which they move between the atmosphere and the land biosphere and the ocean and so on, imposes a timescale. You can't dither and procrastinate indefinitely. And in fact, it's urgent that action happened within a few years. Okay, here's some illustrations of what I've just said. I said emissions are going up. Emissions come mainly from fossil fuel, also from land use changes from some industries like cement manufacturing. But 1990 was the base year for the ill-starred Kyoto Protocol. Had Kyoto been signed by everybody and had nobody cheated, then we would have emissions today, in the so-called first compliance period, of a few percent, 5% or so, below 1990. As you can see, it's 41% above 1990. So if you like a little metaphor here, we're in the position, the world is in the position of a fat person that ought to be taking in a few calories to become less obese, but is actually taking in more every year. And as you can see, in about 2003, the slope of this graph changes. And so it's now growing more rapidly than it did for the first two-thirds or so of the graph. This is temperature. Temperature shown vertically, and time from 1960 on the left to 2010 on the right. The dots are annual averages. This is the temperature of the air near the ocean, near the surface of the Earth, measured at weather stations, and temperatures of the ocean measured by satellites and ships. The ups and downs on this graph, the red line just connects the annual values. The ups and downs are mainly El Nino, La Nina. In El Nino years, it's warm. In La Nina years, it's cold. So that if the skeptic who lives down the block from you says, well, you know, there hasn't been any warming since 1998, that just means that he's cherry-picking the 1998 El Nino year as a place to start. Whereas, in fact, it's still warming if you do the statistics right, either formally or by eye. And, in fact, 2008 was a La Nina year, but 2009 was the start of an El Nino, which is continuing now, so the chances are good that 2010 will be up above the mark. But none of this year-to-year stuff matters a whit if you're looking at long-term trends. The right thing to do is to take 20 or 30-year averaging periods. The black line going from left to right is the mean forecast of how much area would be taken up by sea ice in the Arctic at its annual minimum in September. And you can see the gradual decrease. The blue area around that is the range of the models assessed by IPCC, and the red area is the observations. So here's an example where the climate is changing more quickly than had been foreseen by the most extreme models. This is very complicated. Sea ice has a lot to do with temperature, of course. It melts when the ocean's warm, but it has a lot to do with winds and ocean currents and how the ice is blown around. There's a lot of interannual variability. It's an area of active research. But Arctic sea ice feeds back on climate. It's one of the many, many interesting nonlinear connections in the climate system. Less sea ice, for example, means that the sunlight hits instead of bright ice that you can reflect it away, it hits dark ocean, which will absorb it. So it feeds back positively. It's a vicious cycle. When you warm the world and reduce the amount of sea ice, the changed absorption due to the darkening of the surface enhances or increases or amplifies the warming. Here in map form is the sea ice minimum, that's the white in 2007, compared with the average minimum in the years since the satellite observations began in 1979, which is that sort of mustard yellow, larger area. So this is a very, very drastic reduction in Arctic sea ice. So as I said, it not only has consequences for marine animals that need the ice, but also for the reflectivity in the climate system. To me, this is a very striking graph, but I'm a geek. The red line marked tide gauges is the way sea level used to be measured. A tide gauge is basically a simple float at a shoreline installation. There's a tide gauge at the end of the pier. It's Cook's Institution of Oceanography, for example, in La Jolla. And the blue arrows, the blue lines, are satellite observations by an extraordinary technique. It's called satellite altimetry. The technology is so sweet now that the satellite can measure with high precision the distance between it and the surface. And so you have a global measurement of how far the level of the sea is changing. You can convert that to sea level rise, and you can see that it's first of all, it meets the tide gauges too, which is more accurate, and it's worldwide, it's global in coverage, but it's at the high end of the IPCC predictions. And we now think that that's due to the fact that sea level is being importantly contributed to by melting ice on Greenland and Antarctica. They're covered by big ice sheets, and when the 2007 IPCC report was written, IPCC concluded, and we argued and wrestled and agonized over this, we concluded that we didn't know enough about how the ice volume was changing on Greenland and Antarctica to make quantitative estimates of its contribution to sea level rise. You see, ice melts and icebergs calf off the edge at the same time snowfall adds to the ice, and it's not easy. What has happened since then is an amazing satellite technology. There's a mission called GRACE, which is contrived, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, gravity, rub, 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 and climate experiment or something. And GRACE is a pair of satellites flying in formation, one after the other. And the inter-satellite distance, which they can measure down to very, very high accuracy, is affected by the gravity anomalies beneath it. So gravity changes when the ice volume changes. And so you can convert that. And now we think that most of the sea level rise that we're seeing is, in fact, not due to thermal expansion, but due to the melting of ice on Greenland and Antarctica, both of which are contributing to sea level rise. And today's forecast for sea level rise by the end of the current century is an average of 1 meter, 3 feet and change, whereas the IPCC report has 60 centimeters as a high end. So there's an example where the IPCC report, based on the science available a few years ago, underestimated the sea level change. I'm coming to the end of my 45 minutes, and I wanted to show you this picture. This is, I think, the important figure from the Copenhagen Diagnosis. This report you can download for free. And you're looking at three possible emissions trajectories. This is a time dependence diagram. 2005 is on the left, 2010 is the dashed vertical line where we are now, 2050 is at the right, and what's being graphed here is the global rate at which we emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. You see, it's the global rate that matters. Because it stays in the atmosphere a long time, the amount of CO2 over UCLA today has nothing to do with emissions from Los Angeles, because some of those CO2 molecules are centuries old, and the wind has had plenty of time to mix them around. So for climate purposes, the CO2 amount everywhere away from, you know, urban pollution and so on is the same, and it's the result of the emissions from the world altogether, which has been homogenized by the winds. So what you're seeing here is three possible trajectories for the future. If the world were to decide to reduce emissions globally, which it ought to do and has not yet done, then they could peak as early as next year and then start to decline. That's the green line. I call this, the Copenhagen Diagnosis didn't give this graph a name, I call it the ski slope diagram, and the green line is the bunny slope. You see, it's a gentle gliding path, and if you start the emissions, you're basically, physics tells you that there's only a certain amount of CO2 you can put in the atmosphere if you want to keep the warming below 2 degrees. And you express that probabilistically because a lot has to do with the uncertainty of climate sensitivity to CO2 and so on. But as you see in the label at the bottom left, these are emissions trajectories that give you a three out of four chance of limiting global warming to that 2 degrees above pre-industrial. And if you peak them right away and decline slowly, then by mid-century, you see the green line hasn't yet hit the bottom by the far right, then you have a chance of still being able to use some fossil fuels. If you, incidentally, if you just emitted at the rate you were emitting in 2009, no increase, no decrease, then you get 20 more years. After 20 more years of emissions at the 2009 rate, if you want to have a good chance of keeping it to 2 degrees, you have to cut off right then. So after 20 years, you have to have some magic technology instantaneously replacing fossil fuels, which of course is impossible. 2015, the blue line there, where you peak at 2015, means you have to decline more rapidly. This is not rocket science. The area under these curves is the same, you see, the total emissions. And if you wait till the end of the decade, 2020, then you have to start decreasing emissions at 9% per year. And that's not easy. Maybe it's not possible. It's certainly not easy. This is the urgency. This is what science tells you, that once you've accepted 2 degrees as a target, once you've accepted the finding in climate science, then Mother Nature tells you, not Greenpeace, not Al Gore, but the climate system tells you that you have to start to decrease emissions this decade, and the later you wait to do that, the steeper you have to reduce them. I'm not going to talk, A, I'm out of time, and B, I don't like to talk in apocalyptic terms, but you see down at the bottom, securityandclimate.cna.org, that's a think tank, and if you go to that URL, you can download a report written by 11 retired flag officers of the U.S. military from all four services. These are 3- and 4-star generals and admirals who produced an extraordinary report in 2007 whose four main conclusions are shown here. These are down-to-earth, practical people, and they got themselves briefed by the best climate scientists. And they concluded, quite aside from what you might think about what happens to the Katrinas of the world and what happens to water supply in California, they concluded that climate change was a threat multiplier, it was an important factor in national security for these reasons here. It would destabilize already vulnerable parts of the world, leading to rogue states, environmental refugees, failed states, civil wars, and so on. And it's sobering reading. These are not extreme environmentalists or extreme anythings. And they said, by the way, the report is written extremely bluntly and plainly. They said, we know the science isn't certain. We've spent our careers in the military. If you wait for certainty on the battlefield, something very, very bad is going to happen to you. You have to make decisions on incomplete information. I highly recommend this report if you want to read something sobering and chilling, in fact, about the consequences of unmitigated climate change. I'm only showing this graph of carbon dioxide versus time because it's considered very tasteless for a professor at Scripps to give a talk on this topic without showing it. This is the most famous graph in earth sciences. This is the record of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere measured by Charles David Keeling, who spent his whole career at Scripps, who invented the instrument. This is why we know CO2 is increasing. These data are rock solid. This is a picture of Dave Keeling. I knew him very well for the last half of this curve. That's his observatory on the slopes of Mauna Loa in Hawaii. He struggled all his life for acceptance and for funding to keep this rather modest instrument going. And today, you can see it up on the upper left there. This is the Great Hall of the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. You can see on the right the double helix and Darwin's finches and several other iconic figures. And Keeling's curve belongs there, too. It's still continuing. Dave died in 2005. It's being continued by an international group and by his son, Ralph, who's a professor at Scripps. You can see the red line is the annual curve. It wiggles, by the way, because of the biosphere breathing, but because of photosynthesis and respiration. Spring is coming earlier. The annual cycles are bigger, and CO2 is continuing to increase. So that better than 1 out of 4 molecules of CO2 in the atmosphere today is there because mankind has put it there. This is a plug for a wonderful book that I'm too modest to tell you more about. I'm going to save some of this for the discussion period, but to give you a hint of it, because I do want to close up, and 45 minutes is coming to a close here, and I promise to be good. Sherry Rowland, who's at Irvine, and who shared the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1995 for the ozone work, was frustrated when the world didn't agree to ban ozone quickly enough. I've asked him whether he thinks this is true of global warming. He says, absolutely. It's very frustrating now that the science is so good, but what we're doing with the predictions is not basing our policy on them. I want to talk about this. I want to talk about communication problems, but we have a big, long discussion period coming up, so I will save this. But we have many problems in convincing the world of this. And in fact, in recent years, Americans, polling data shows, have been less and less willing to believe that global warming is real and serious and human-caused. Part of this is science illiteracy. Part of this is the disinformation. Part of this is the fact that we had a presidential election some years ago, and if you tell me whether somebody voted for Bush or Gore, I can tell you with high confidence what they think about an inconvenient truth. The message and the messenger are conflated. And I think the IPCC has done a great job, last point here. It does wonderful assessment. It's not so good at communication. And I think we're still waiting for the people who can take the raw material in the IPCC report and convert it to movies and TV documentaries and textbooks and so on. And here are some URLs. And maybe I'll leave this up during the handover to Matt here. There's the top thing there is some interviews I did. I recommend my site for many downloads and links. There's the Copenhagen Diagnosis site again. Climate Central has supplied a lot of good science communication. You'll see their pieces on Jim Lehrer's NewsHour, for example. And climatecommunication.org is the private site of an excellent science writer. Many, many good links, too. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.